I'd like to just thank everyone for coming and for the invitation here. It's not a long way from Germany, but some would say perhaps it is. Primarily I work in modern post-revolution societies, particularly those who had gone through revolution and are now looking to write their constitutions, particularly in the Arab and Islamic world. So most recently I've been working in Yemen and Sudan. We played quite a major role in helping to advise on the draft constitution of the South Sudan, which was not an Islamic constitution, but it obviously had to navigate through such issues after its secession from Sudan. One thing I'd like to make clear, though, however, is that because of some of my work in these countries, I can't perhaps go into details about some of the things that we've witnessed, but I'm happy to discuss them off the record if anyone's interested. So I'm going to start, and it's always, like I mentioned earlier, it's a very difficult task to follow up on Robert Gleaves. So I'm going to defer to him on some of the points that he's mentioned yesterday, and hope that most of what I'm going to say is an addition and not a repetition of that. So in furtherance to that, I don't want to, and I don't see it as particularly necessary, to offer any precise definition of the term or concept of the Sharia as we understand it in the Western world. This is largely because in our discourse, the Sharia is either characterized narrowly as an archaic or imprecise and unchanging legal system, which harks back to the past, rarely looks forward. But there's also the alternative, which is the exact opposite of this, generally through polemical discourse or defensive rhetoric. Both, I think, however, comprise equally exaggerated claims. So I don't think it's very helpful to actually attempt to define what the Sharia is, a bit like we discussed yesterday. What I also don't want to do is provide competing claims on behalf of various religious and secular groups as to their aspersions regarding what the Sharia is or isn't. What we do know, and what may be worth considering, are the following. Firstly, the Sharia covers more than just positive law in the traditional sense of positive law, which differs from the concept of natural law, which is rights that are inherent, in the modern context perhaps secular, or God-given, religious, and it is law plus. It's law and something else. It's not just solely law. Nevertheless, it contains within it rulings, the ahkam, which are derived by Muslim jurists and applied by Muslim judges, and it is this that is referred to when Muslim jurists generally speak of the ahkam al-sharia, which Robert elaborated on yesterday. Secondly, it refers to the legal process that stems from these primary sources together with the secondary legal tools or the methodologies which are used to derive understandings and interpretations of the laws, such as the fiqh, for example. That's a secondary element to it. And by this process, the revealed sources are understood by those who are qualified according to various legal methodologies and schools of thought in order to arrive at a sound opinion as to the law relating to a matter. Constitutional governance. In the legal sense, if we talk about constitutions purely in the legal sense for a moment, this refers to principles that either limit or control the powers of governments in accordance with the fundamental rights of citizens and communities, as well as the rule of law, to ensure that the relationship between the individuals and the state is regulated and defined along legal principles of general application, as opposed to being regulated by a ruling and unelected elite. Therefore, the Constitution serves as a general reference to a document that refers to these principles, the principles that regulate the divesting of authority in a specific institution or a governing body, and principles that regulate the powers that each institution is endowed with by the people or from the people. Further to this, it also serves as a declaration of formal sovereignty announced on behalf of the people of the sovereign entity by the authorities who have been divested this authority. I think that one of the difficulties here is perhaps that particularly for Islamic countries, constitutionalism in its modern form, as it's currently understood today, promotes the existence and supremacy of a higher law to which the political and governmental order is bound and accountable to. And this higher law clashes with the Muslim conception or perception of the Sharia, because for the Muslim perception, the Sharia is the highest law. And that's where I see one fundamental divergence between the two approaches of constitutionalism on the one hand and modern Muslim legal desire to establish the Sharia on the other hand. So this higher law, in the constitutional sense, is beyond arbitrary or capricious changes, whether suggested by an autocrat, a democratic representation, or even by duly constituted legislature. This is one of the challenging aspects for the proponents of the Sharia, as the higher law, if not expressly the Sharia, would be directly in competition with it. And like I said, there is nothing higher in the estimation of Muslims than the Sharia. So I'd suggest that the constitutional systems contain at their core at least three elements. The first is limited and accountable government. The second is adherence to the rule of law. And the third is protection of fundamental rights. If you look at modern constitutions and how they're being drafted nowadays, at least since the last 20 years or more, you will find that these three are the fundamental principles that any constitution tends to try to abide by. And the problem there is, or not the problem, let's say the optimistic approach there is that technically or theoretically, if the Sharia that is posited by Islamic political parties meets these three requirements, theoretically it should be compatible with modern constitutionalism. And I don't know a modern Islamic political party which diverges from these three principles, except unless they have been really unsuccessful because they promote something which is, in the sense, a kind of autocracy or a theocracy, because you don't meet those three criteria in those cases. So it could be said that the provisions and principles contained in the Sharia, if they provide principles or provisions that abide by these criteria, would be compatible with constitutionalism. The next point I wanted to look at is the intersection of the Sharia and constitutions. Do they come together at all? Is there a point at which they meet or can generate something new and dynamic and innovative? The modern nation-state phenomenon is very different in its theory, structure, and objectives to the historical pattern in early Islam, and Robert touched on this yesterday. In the classical period of Islam, in the medieval, pre-modern period, you have tribal affiliations and tribal contracts and pacts and treaties between various tribes and peoples. These pacts and treaties tended to regulate their social, political, and trade relations, largely. And there was also a security element in it. Often there was no independent or elected hierarchy to which one could turn to guarantee and realize the rights of the individual or the collective. Rather, these treaties contained within them aspects like the modern-day equivalent of the breach clause. So, for example, if you have a treaty between two parties and the treaty is breached by either party, what happens in case of a breach of a term of the agreement? And to whom does that dispute then go to? Who is adjudicating that dispute? So these treaties contain within them these kind of things. And if you look at them to compare them from that perspective, some of them do hold up early modern legal documents, pacts and treaties between the Muslims and non-Muslims in various parts of the Arab world, do hold up to modern constitutional standards, or at least principles of modern constitutions. There is a lot of debate about this, and I might mention it later if we have time, but the Medinan constitution is a hotly debated document as to whether it is a constitution or not. I don't think anyone, however, denies that articles within the Medinan constitution, which was an early document which the Prophet had entered into when he came to Medina with tribes of the Jewish and non-Muslim alliances in order to form a pact of security. There is debate as to whether it reflects a constitutional document in the modern sense of the term, at least, or whether it was ever envisaged as a constitutional document. Nevertheless, it does contain certain constitutional provisions, which, if they were found in any modern constitutional document, would be absolutely valid and perfectly constitutional. So that's something which we could compare. Whether the document itself is a constitution is perhaps for another discussion and forum. So, although there are constitutional principles, I would say, that are contained in the Islamic legal sources, and here I'm talking particularly of the sources, so the sources that Muslim jurists accept as being the foundations of the Sharia, which is also debated, such as the limits of authority of authoritarians, the limits of the executive, and the limits imposed upon the citizens, there is some debate as to whether there is a constitution in the early history of Islamic law in the modern context, in the modern understanding of the word constitution. It is clear that some of the textual sources of the Sharia, namely the Quran as well as early treaties, contain articles and provisions that are clearly of a constitutional nature. So the proponents of the idea that in the history of Islamic law there existed the first or earliest ever codified constitution, they cite the constitution of Medina as a precedent. And modern political parties, be they in Egypt, Tunisia, even to some extent in Yemen and Libya, they have constantly referred to the constitution of Medina as an example of an Islamic constitution. So in their rhetoric, in their political rallying, they use this as an example to try and give off this assumption that there is something which is indigenous to Islam, which is compatible with constitutionalism. I won't go into the constitution in any more detail, I think. What I would mention, perhaps, is that the constitution doesn't outline a distinctly political system. That has to be clear, because it wasn't envisaged as a political document in the sense of governing a certain area. Nevertheless, it does have breach clauses, and what happens in case of a dispute. Generally, the prophet was referred to in cases of dispute. So there are aspects that are worthy of studying in that context. In coming back to the modern period, virtually all of the 44 or so Muslim majority countries have embraced the idea that a constitution is an essential feature of modern governance. Nearly all of them have promulgated formal constitutions, mostly beginning from this post-independence or post-revolution period. However, promulgating and establishing constitutionalism as a form of governance are two very different things. One need only look towards Iraq and Libya and the difficulties they are having in ensuring enforcement and compliance with constitutional principles. Until now, none has managed to instill a tradition of constitutionalism, and many could be held up as examples of the abject failure of constitutional government. I personally am not too disheartened by this, because no Arab or Islamic state which has a constitution has had really the level of time that other states have had in order to experiment with this concept. So even if you look at the American constitution, I mean, till this day, constitutional provisions are severely debated, and I think that's part of a healthy constitution, that the moment that you arrive at a final decision as to what the constitution means is a cause for stagnation, perhaps, rather than a cause for evolution of constitutional principles. From a purely philosophical legal point of view, the ideal proposed by some of constructing a just and legitimate state around or based upon the principles of Sharia, Islamic law, and the Islamic tradition, Islamic legal tradition, I think, has the capacity to continue to grow in appeal if the past decade is in any way representative of its growth and popularity. With its growth, I think, will come its development as well as its complexities. This divergence seems to be most notable between abstraction of the idea that the state and its functions are governed and administered by Sharia, and the reality of whether this is actually the case, and whether those abstractions are ever implemented. So, for example, the status quo in Libya or Iraq or Afghanistan has been exactly that. The abstractions were attractive alternatives at the outset, particularly prior to the circumstances that brought about the new constitutions in each of these cases. But it was importantly, I think it was felt by the citizenry that the people who once rallied around those ideas quickly become disillusioned. So the people who support the ideals of having the Sharia instituted or implemented within the constitution quickly see that the theory is very different to the practice. And once they see that the difficulties in implementing the Sharia on a constitutional level, they become disillusioned and then tend to switch to liberal political parties. Unless those philosophical ideas are translated into institutional principles and modes of governance whose effects are felt by the average citizen of the state, the proponents of calls to implement the Sharia will quickly be replaced by more realistic socialist representatives who also claim that their socialist policies are in conformity with certain aspects of the Sharia. Which is interesting, because on the one hand you have, let's say far-right Islamic political parties who are claiming that the Sharia should be implemented. On the other hand, you have liberal parties who say that all of their principles and all of their mandates are in line with the principles of the Sharia. So the Sharia is up for competition. It's up for grabs in these political environments. So if we briefly scan the evolution of the philosophical debate from the last 20 years or so, the debate centered around whether the state should be Islamic or secular, and this shows the evolution of it. It was considered by most, mainly parties who promoted a secular state, that democracy and Islamic statehood were at odds and were totally incompatible. This argument was also, which is almost obsolete now, was also experienced by Catholicism and democracy many centuries ago. But the question that is asked now relates to an institutional question. I'm going to deal with two main points now. How long do I have left?
You've got about another 5 minutes.
So, navigating the Sharia through a modern constitutional framework, and I want to speak particularly about this concept of the choice of laws. There are two, perhaps, models that could be proposed, or are proposed. The most optimistic model would suggest that the proponents of the Sharia will radically alter the construct and constitution of the fundamental organs and institutions of the state, ensuring that they are designed around certain defined and accepted principles or concepts derived from the Sharia. This will almost be a form of constitutional design, something which is quite popular nowadays, or what's called the Sharia way. For example, in Egypt and many other countries, you have popular slogans which relate and refer to the Sharia constantly. Al-Islam wa al-Hal, Islam is the solution, for example. Many Muslim-majority countries have already started this process, but have not yet taken it to its fruition. The developments that have taken place so far include the inclusion, within the constitutional architecture, of legislative forums such as the Shura Council, the Majlis al-Shura, has been brought within the constitution. And another thing which perhaps was prevalent in medieval Christendom, which is a body of senior scholars who have been given a certain place within the constitution as having certain legislative authorities. So, for example, in Egypt you have the Hay'at al-Ulama, a body of senior religious scholars, some of whom are elected, some of whom are appointed. Tunisia has an interesting divergence in this. So, it seems that although there is a long way to go before the optimistic model is achieved, whereby there is an engendering of the provisions from the Sharia or aspects of legislative development from the Sharia within constitutions, I think there is still a long way to go before we reach full fruition on that. Nevertheless, the fact that the process has started already and is growing in influence hints at its future development and further advancement as more countries experiment with these models. At the other end is the most pessimistic model, outright collapse of both institutions and the state's architecture. This is perhaps slightly more realistic if you look at the history of what's happening in Iraq at the moment, where the constitution is almost, it's impossible to implement the constitution in a practical way. And we can go into this later, but I think the fact that the Iraqi constitution was drafted in a period of about 6 months has something really to say about that. If you look at the South African constitution, in contrast, which took many, many years to come to its completion, you see the fact that the South African constitution has a strong applicability and enforcement mechanism. Islamic political parties exercising constitutional authority will try to design institutions that may not work well within the current state's architecture. They will be subject to the same kinds of problems and constraints as other governments that operate in similar countries. But it seems clear that the possibility of this occurring is greatest where legal transplants occur. When the exercise of constitutional authority attempts to merely transplant principles and rulings derived from the Sharia and moulds them forcibly to fit the modern institutional framework of the state. This would be a gross anathema, especially when one looks to the legal environments in which those processes originally took root, i.e. the pre-medieval period. I'm just going to, because I'm reaching the end of my time, I wanted to just highlight a few things here. These are some examples which were mentioned by Rob yesterday as well, and I think will probably be mentioned by Masuda later. The source of law clause is something which is highly debated in most Arab and Middle Eastern Arab and Islamic constitutions. By Islamic constitutions, I mean constitutions of Islamic countries. The Article 2 in Egypt has a long history of jurisprudence, especially if you look to the Supreme Court, Supreme Constitutional Court of Egypt. They have a very lively and enlightening debate about what this means and what this entails. But with the latest draft of the constitution, we have the inclusion from the 1971 draft, in fact, verbatim, of this provision that the principles of Islamic Sharia are the principal sources of legislation, or the chief sources of legislation, however you want to translate that. Then you have something else. You have the introduction of an institution which has interpretative authority, which is not a court structure. Generally, in constitutions, they have the constitutional court, identified it within the Constitution as saying the Constitutional Court has ultimate authority in interpreting the constitutionality and legality of laws. Here, that authority has been given to Al-Azhar, as well as perhaps the Constitutional Court, which will be an interesting. It will be interesting to see how that develops. Not only this, you also have the concept of plurality of legal systems within the Egyptian Constitution. So, if you look after Article 2, I think it's Article 3, I have it here somewhere, but there is the express provision for Jewish and Christian law for Jews and Christians. How the state is going to implement that, who is going to be interpreting that, is unaddressed. It's not addressed within the Constitution. But it's a novel approach. You have to give them credit for innovative thinking. But it's something which they have, again, they've transplanted this from traditional models. If you look to Andalusian Spain, where Muslims were ruling Christians, the Christians were ruling Muslims, each of them had individual legal systems running at the same time in parallel. So it seems like they have worked this out from a pre-existing paradigm.
As I'm going to have to get you to...
I will conclude with this one. The definition of the Sharia, I'll leave for now, but particularly one interesting aspect is the Article 219 tries to define what the Sharia is, and we mentioned this briefly yesterday as well. This is something which isn't there in any other constitution as far as I know. It expressly mentions the reasons, the actual constituent elements of what the Sharia should entail. This is problematic for various aspects which we can perhaps go into later, but one of the things that strikes me in this is that not only have they stated that these things make up the sources of the Sharia, but they have, it seems like this was a compromise. If you leave the Sharia out, i.e. the secular liberal parties were saying, if you leave the Sharia out of the Constitution, you can put this in. And in fact, if you read the debates of the Constitutional Assembly that took place at that time, you see that there was a real, the Brotherhood and the Anur party especially, had a real difficult time in trying to make sure that the Sharia was included within the Constitution, but the secularist parties accepted that this would be acceptable if they defined it in another article further down in the Constitution. I hope that's given some kind of context to things. I'm sorry for the haphazard display and presentation, but I look forward to...
Well, Suresh, thank you very much. That was a very enlightening talk.